As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. To me, being a gangster was better than being president of the United States. To me, it meant being somebody in a neighborhood that was full of nobodies. They weren't like anybody else. I mean, they did whatever they wanted.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus movie review of Goodfellas.
After a while, it got to be all normal. None of it seemed like crimes. Our husbands weren't brain surgeons. They were blue-collar guys. The only way they could make extra money, real extra money, was to go out and cut a few corners.
Hosted by Stewart.
It's just, you know, you're just funny. It's you know, the way you tell the story and everything.
Jacob.
He's a good earner, but he's wild. Takes too many chances.
And Arnie.
You're gonna like this guy. He's all right. He's a good fella. He's one of us. You understand?
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Hey, fuckhead, I'm talking to you. You don't want to say a fucking word to me, you don't have to say anything to me. I don't really give a fuck.
Listener discretion is advised.
So what are you going to tell us, tough guy? I said, my usual, zero, nothing. I tell you, fuck. He says, no, you're going to tell me something today, tough guy. I said, all right, I'll tell you something.
Today we're fucking discussing the motherfucking Goodfellas, starring Robert De Niro, Ray Liotta, fucking Joe Pesci, Lorraine Bracco, and Paul Sorvino, directed by Martin fucking Scorsese. This is Arnie Two Times, your fucking co-host of Now Playing, here with my Goodfellas.
Yeah, you're a funny guy, Arnie. This is Stuart.
Funny how? Do I amuse you? Am I a clown?
Sometimes, yeah.
And this is the host that, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a podcaster. This is Jacob.
And I always wanted to cover Goodfellas, so thank you, May Donors, for finally enabling it to happen. I don't know how we would have ever gotten to it otherwise.
No, but Goodfellas, this is a movie that you didn't have to push me too hard to watch. I wanted to rewatch this for years. I remember it coming out in theaters back in 90, getting a whole hell of a lot of buzz. I didn't see it in theaters, but when it was a new release on VHS, I watched it. Strangely, I watched it with my father. It was one of the very few times our cinematic tastes intersected. Anything with Pacino or De Niro, my father would see. Sometimes he'd send me to the video store and say, bring me back one with a known actor. And I'm like, Charlie Sheen, who's known to you? He's like, Pacino or De Niro, one of those two. And so since this had De Niro in it, he wanted to see it. I wanted to see it. That's the only time I did, though. I think maybe in college it was on HBO a few times and we'd stand around and laugh at Joe Pesci. But I've wanted to revisit this movie a long time. Happy for the chance. So thank you, patrons.
I've seen this movie several times, but I wanted to read the book. So that's the difference this time around, is I always knew it was based on this 1985 nonfiction novel, Wise Guys, Life in a Mafia Family. And so for this time, for the first time, I've been able to read the book and see how similar it is.
It took me a long time to get to this one, but I have revisited it often since I've seen it. I think it was actually that Scorsese DiCaprio series that got me to finally sit down and watch this. I always knew, oh yeah, there's this movie, Goodfellas. All these gangster movies came out in the 90s. There's some good ones, there's some bad ones. It was just like, oh yeah, that's a movie I know. And finally it was on TV one night. I'm like, oh, I'll watch the first 5 minutes of this, see if it's any good, and maybe I'll get the disc on Netflix. And then I sat there for like the next, because it was on TV and there's commercials like 3.5 hours or something, because I was just like, oh, this movie's amazing, I need to watch this one more often. And this is one probably every 18 months that my wife and I sit down and watch this one, because we're both fans.
I have to believe, if you see one Martin Scorsese movie in your life, this is probably the one.
This is the one that should have won the Oscar for him.
It famously lost everything to Dances with Wolves except supporting actor. But even though it didn't make a whole lot of money at the time, it broke even, it made double its budget, it has grown in appeal. It has been the popular one in the long run. Now that we are here in 2018, probably much more popular than Dances with Wolves was in 1990.
Dances with Wolves holds up. I've seen it recently. But of the two, Goodfellas is the one that I hold more dear. When I think of Dances with Wolves, I forget that it's actually a good movie, and it ends up coming off a little bit sappy in my memory and a little bit slow. Whereas this one, this is like an epitome of a guy's movie. It held the world record for the most number of fucks in a movie up until that point. Very few female characters. There is one notable one that we'll discuss, but I've never not thought of this film fondly.
Come on, forget about Dance with Wolves. Obviously, audiences chose My Blue Heaven, which came out a month before this. Steve Martin, Rick Moranis, based on Henry Hill, too. We had two Henry Hill movies a month apart.
Wow, I didn't realize that it actually, I mean, it felt influenced by that. But again, 1990, I mentioned this on the Godfather 3 show. There were so many mob movies. But this is actually Hill's story twice?
Yeah, the author of Wise Guys, who Goodfellas was based on, Nicholas Pileggi, his wife did the screenplay for My Blue Heaven.
Who's his wife?
Nora Ephron.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, she's big time.
Yeah, I mean, she's the rom-com person. Sleepless in Seattle and...
Oh, okay.
When Harry Met Sally was her claim to fame. Yeah.
Right. She went on to direct. I was thinking more her directing stuff.
Yeah. A much-loved writer of many films, big hits.
But My Blue Heaven was not one of them.
Yeah, My Blue Heaven, for those that don't know the film, it was, what does a mobster do after he's put in the witness protection program? He does a lot of cute things that Steve Martin can get away with and irritate Rick Moranis, and it was more comedy than it was mob movie. I'll just leave it at that. There were many mob movies to choose from in 1990. That one didn't register. The one I pointed to already, Godfather 3, a very different film, probably just as acclaimed at the time, but I think in retrospect has faded in memory compared to Goodfellas.
I'm blown away that these came out the same year because they are such different film. I mean, about similar material, but so different, the style, everything.
I'm blown away that you say they were equally acclaimed at the time. It must have been that critics were just so far up the Godfather's ass that they couldn't see the forest for the trees on that one.
They were both nominated for the same amount of Oscars, and I remember reading a lot of very positive things about Godfather 3 at first, and then that's faded over time, whereas Goodfellas, its reputation has only grown.
Thanks to TNT. They know drama, and they know how to replay movies into the ground.
And yet, I'd hate to have ever watched this with edited dialogue. I mean, what's it without its four-letter words?
That's how good it is that I was transfixed with the television edit of it.
All of that dialogue was written by Nick Pileggi, who wrote the novel, but who was largely transcribing an interview with a real person. At the core of all of this debauched tale is a true story. And I do think that that's why it has such a grip, ultimately, is of how authentic this story comes across. The Godfather, Mario Puzo, did research, but largely made all of that stuff up. He didn't know mobsters. He didn't know what they were like. He imagined something, and it ended up being a big hit. And I think real mafiosos patterned themselves on that novel. But here's the story of an actual mob guy telling you what it was like to be low level. A guy who was never going to rise to the top, but did a lot of things that raise eyebrows and we want to know about.
I haven't read the book, but my wife, she's a huge Howard Stern fan. And she's like, oh yeah, Henry Hill, he would call into the show all the time. I looked up some of the clips on YouTube that people have uploaded. And yeah, he's very much like the way Ray Liotta portrays him. Just so different than Marlon Brando or Pacino. Like, yeah, just a very different view of the mob.
Yeah, for a guy that's in witness protection, he sure pops up a whole lot, Henry Hill.
But just call into one of the biggest radio shows in the world.
He got kicked out of witness protection. I didn't know that you could get expelled from witness protection, but he did.
Well, he did get into trouble in between the book and the movie. They make it clear at the end of the movie that while the book came out in 1985, it's very clear he hated suburbia because he kept committing crimes, and it was said that he did something with narcotics in 1987, and I don't know if that was a factor or not, but his marriage dissolved all before Goodfellas even came out. But how did Scorsese come on board? Well, he was doing a lot of commercial projects in the 1980s. His star had faded since Raging Bull, and he was doing whatever he could find. And he was shooting a Tom Cruise movie, Color of Money, when he read Nick Pileggi's book, called the author up and says, I'll do anything to develop this. Thought it would be perfect for him. Nick Pileggi agreed. They co-wrote the screenplay together. It was put on hold. It probably would have come out much earlier. Put on hold because Scorsese finally got the money to make his real passion project, Last Temptation of Christ. He really needed a commercial picture after that. He was being boycotted.
Oh, yeah.
And it was quite scandalous at the time. It could have maybe even ruined his career. He needed a big hit, and this was the perfect one to do it.
Yeah, when this came out, I was starting to learn directors, but there was no IMDb. I had the Leonard Maltin guides and things. All I really knew about Scorsese was the controversial Christ film he made in the 80s. You know, that was all over the news, and I was reading the entertainment pages. So I didn't really know about Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and all that stuff. When Goodfellas came out, I knew this was the Last Temptation of Christ guy.
Oh, interesting. See, I feel like his reputation was as that mob guy, which is funny because he had actually never really made an official mob movie before. Goodfellas is the first time he's ever done what I would call a mob movie. He's made movies about hoodlums. He's Italian-Americans that commit crimes, you know, who's knocking at my door or Mean Streets. I wouldn't call those mob movies. And Taxi Driver is an assassin. He's a lone wolf. And Raging Bull, he's a boxer. I mean, even though we think of him being perfect for this wise guy book, it really wasn't something he'd ever done before. Not in this way. And he wanted to capture the book in total. I would say, just in general, if you're thinking about reading this book, you already have. This movie condenses so much of the book and the voice and the tone and the way that it's put together that the only thing I think you get from reading the book that's not on film is just details. If you actually want to know step by step how some of these heists are committed, you'll get more of that stuff in the book. But honestly, it's amazing how that 250-page book comes out into this 2.5-hour movie.
And that book, again, it's written by Pledgy. Did he interview Hill? Did he just do research?
Yeah, he had hours and hours of audio tape. He sat down with the guy and just let him talk, gave him a bag of potato chips and said, tell me everything. And they had to have clandestine meetings. I mean, he would fly somewhere and wouldn't even know where he's going and then be put on another airplane and end up somewhere else. It took like 3 trips before he could finally meet Hill. Hill was very much in hiding at this time. He had limited access. It wasn't like he had his cell phone or that there even was cell phones and he could ring them up in the middle of the night. They were very controlled, brief interviews that he audio recorded and then largely transcribed and rearranged, finessed so that it would work as a story, but it largely feels like an interview, and not just an interview with Hill, but also his ex-wife, Karen, and his mistresses, as well as some of the FBI people pop up as well. Now, the movie had, I think, the biggest budget Scorsese had ever been offered at this time. $25 million sounds like nothing, but
no.
It was a lot at that time. Certainly for this kind of movie, I think it was considered risky since Scorsese movies don't generally make a lot of money either. But Warner Brothers was all in to give this man his comeback film. And the only thing they didn't like was, who's this Ray Liotta? I mean, we get Robert De Niro, right? Even Joe Pesci had been in Raging Bull.
And Lethal Weapon 2.
Not to mention Home Alone the same year. But yes, who's Ray Liotta? Have you guys ever seen Something Wild?
No, I've heard of it. To me, you say Ray Liotta, I just think Goodfellas. I guess he was Shoeless Joe Jackson in Field of Dreams the year before. I kind of remember him in that role, but this could be the only thing he's ever done, and you don't need to do anything else. He's so good.
Yeah, this is where he exploded on the scene. I had seen him in Field of Dreams before that and recognized him, same hair, same look, but really, this is where I learned who he was, and everything I've ever seen him do after this seems tinged by this role. Like, yeah. You're never going to see him play the totally good guy in a rom-com. You're never going to see him play a cop who's not a little bit corrupt, you know? I mean, I go to the movie Heartbreakers, an underrated comedy from early this century, where he's, of course, a chop shop manager who's getting conned by a couple of women. It's just, he's always that guy, even in the Hannibal film we reviewed.
Yeah, when he shows up in A Place Beyond the Pines, I'm like, well, he's a corrupt cop. Because it's Ray Liotta. Of course he's going to be corrupt, whatever role he plays.
I think he's in a J-Lo show doing the same thing, too. Yes, it's become his bread and butter. But at the time, he was considered a relatively fresh face who was modeled to do other things. I think more kind of noble, heroic types. But he had done this little comedy with Jonathan Demme that I actually like a lot. It's kind of a remake of It Happened One Night in 80s style with Melanie Griffith in one of her better roles as this Hellcat woman that takes this man hostage while he's trying to go to his class reunion and upturns his life over a road trip. A lot of fun, and Ray Liotta is the ex-boyfriend that just shows up in the third act, and really, he's scary in that film. And I don't know that you would have associated that with him before. It was the reason he got this role. He really did have to campaign the studio and Nick Pileggi, but Scorsese, you know, he sees every movie ever made, so he saw something wild and said, I want that guy.
And he's surrounded by enough names that there's a cushion. I'm not going to say Liotta gave the best performance in this movie. When you think about the Oscars it didn't win, I wouldn't weep over Liotta. I think Pesci and De Niro and even Paul Sorvino and Lorraine Bracco do a little bit better. But he's certainly the main character, and he's a meme now. I mean,
yes, that laughing meme, yeah.
Yeah,
because he has the best laugh. It is the one of the greatest laughs in history. I didn't know that was a thing. I'm glad he's being celebrated for that. He's not one of our greatest actors, but he is one of our greatest laughers. If this movie only carries on in that way, that's terrific. Of course, it doesn't, and that's why, Arnie, you're going to give him the plot, and we're going to get into all the good things about Goodfellas.
Well, Goodfellas tells the true story of a bunch of New York mobsters from the 50s through the 80s. The plot revolves around Henry Hill, a gangster played by Ray Liotta. He's been in with the mob since he was a teenager. He works for Paulie Cicero, played by Paul Sorvino, and does jobs with Jimmy the Gent Conway, played by Robert De Niro, and hothead Tommy DeVito, played by Joe Pesci. Through robbing airports, hijacking trucks, and other illicit activities, these mobsters make a good living, and Henry falls in love with Karen Friedman, played by Lorraine Bracco. The two get married, but it's not a happy marriage, as Henry goes out at night doing illicit activities, including cheating on his wife with his mistress, Janice. But the mob life is dangerous, especially with Tommy around, who's likely to pull a gun and shoot anyone who looks at him the wrong way, including made men who are untouchable by soldiers like themselves. Henry, Jimmy, and some of the other mobsters get sent to prison for running illegal gambling, and in the joint, Henry survives by having Karen smuggle in drugs he can sell to the inmates. After his sentence is up, Paulie tells Henry to leave the drug dealing alone, but Henry partners with Tommy and Jimmy to sell cocaine anyway without Paulie knowing, and Henry quickly becomes addicted to coke. Things go really south when Jimmy and several other gang members rob $6 million from the JFK airport, bringing down the authorities on the group. To cover himself and to keep all the $6 million for himself, Jimmy starts to kill everyone involved with the heist, and Tommy is killed as retribution for murdering a made man. Henry gets arrested for drug dealing and realizes Paulie won't help him, and Jimmy plans to kill him to cover up the JFK job, so Henry decides to become a police informant and goes into the witness protection program. He gets Paulie and Jimmy convicted, and we find in title cards that Paulie died in prison while Jimmy is serving 20 to life, as credits roll.
And a trope we've seen many times, when they're trying to tell someone's entire life story, maybe it's not always best to start with them as a little baby. You got to give them a hook. And I think that we start in the middle because it really is almost the exact moment that being a mobster goes from being glamorous and fun to being a really bad time. Scorsese wants us to begin selling the idea that these are lowly men. Unlike The Godfather, where we saw people at the top that were pulling the strings and making people kill at their will, these are the guys that get the strings pulled on them. They're the ones that have to go in the back of a car and stab a guy when he's not totally dead.
Yeah, Joe Pesci I might think is low on the ladder, but you see Robert De Niro, that is a surprise, that these are the guys that are going to actually have to dig a grave. But this scene ends up being really important. You just think it's a funny scene where there's a guy in the trunk and he comes to and he starts banging around and they got to go and stab him and shoot him some more. But this is going to be a pivotal moment for the whole story.
I think one of the big things that makes this movie stand out is its humor. I mean, we've reviewed the three Godfather films, and you might smile here or there, like with Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli, but it's not a funny movie. It's a drama. And here, this movie is a drama, but it's a funny movie, too. And kind of my comparative now, when I'm watching it for, I guess, just the second time, start to finish, is Wolf of Wall Street, how that was also a true story that Scorsese told in a very funny manner. When I think of Scorsese, I don't think of him as being a comedian, but he can really do comedy well. And here, the actors he has pulls that together.
Yeah, I like Scorsese comedies. My favorite one of his films is still After Hours, and people really like King of Comedy as well. So it isn't what they think of him for, but I agree with you. This is a black comedy that gets mislabeled as a drama. I spend most of the time darkly laughing about all these horrible deeds, which is not to say that it's not dramatic. We can tell on the look on Ray Liotta's face as he's watching his friends take care of this body that this is not fun for him at all. But it is in the beginning, which is why we go back to 1955.
This is what transfixed me in front of the television when I watched this for the first time. I normally don't like narration in a film. Go to that original cut of Blade Runner. But Liotta, he knows how to read some lines. And it just feels like this 2.5 hour awesome jazz drum solo. And I'm going with it. I'm just sucked in instantly.
I love his way of telling the story. And I love the way it's done visually, too, in that the camera's moving a lot. We're getting some well-lit shots, but then it'll just freeze as he talks about a certain person. And so we get a freeze frame that enables the character to expound a little bit more about the person we're seeing. And then it just goes right back into moving again. And I thought that was a really fun way of being visually exciting. One of my big problems, the reason I don't like voiceover a lot of the times, I look at Ready Player One, is so often they're used for data dumps and they're not interesting. Here, this is a way of telling a really visually interesting and gripping narration. It's like hearing the story from the gangster himself, and he's telling a good story, not a grandpa story.
Yeah, it's a data dump, but it's an entertaining data dump. When he introduces Polly and he's slow moving because he don't come for no one, they come for him. There's just so much style in it.
Yeah, it's the movie's big gambit. It's essentially a book on tape, right? It never stops. There might be a dozen scenes where people actually have drama, but by and large, we're watching montage for 2.5 hours. And that's incredibly daring when you think about it that way. I think the truth of the matter is the first time you watch it, I didn't even realize that. It is because the voice is so strong and so authentic that I think that we just get absorbed into the world. If you're prone to be interested in what being a mobster is like, you're just as hooked as Henry is here when he looks out across at the cab stand and sees these guys he wants to be.
I can kind of relate to the line, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. It's like, there's something about it that was appealing to me as a teenager. And, you know, I had a friend of a friend who was supposedly part of a not so above board operation. And I wanted in. I really did.
I had a similar thing in high school. I knew this girl. She's Italian. She claimed her family was in the mafia. I'm like, hook me up. I want to join. She's like, you're not Italian. You can't be in it. I'm like, come on, make an exception. But yeah, I wanted to do it.
Here they say that you can be in it if you're not Italian, but you'll never be a made man. You have to have all your roots. You have to be a pure-blood Italian to get made. And that's why we've got Henry and Jimmy who can't be made men. But I understand his attraction to the lifestyle. Easy money, easy women, easy power. And he got in it young. And you wonder how he would do that with his parents. I kind of thought his parents might be in it. That's what we see in a lot of mob movies. And The Sopranos, you know, it's literal family. Here, no, he's skipping school and they're going to beat up a mailman to make sure his parents don't find out anymore.
They're going to put him in the pizza oven if he delivers a report card or truancy letter to the home.
And again, it's a black comedy. I love the line that there were no more truancy letters. There were no more report cards. There was no more mail for weeks. My mom had to go complain at the post office. It's a good setup, knock them down, like a stand-up joke.
Yeah, the pattern, the way that these guys work, they're not all talk, believe me. They're action as well, but it is like they're giving a comic routine. These wise guys, that's what being wise is. It's being funny. It's being a funny guy. And you get that sense early on. It's much like that first Godfather. You sense the warmth. Before anything else, you sense these guys are fun to hang out at a barbecue. You could spend all night listening to tales and really be absorbed in it. And that's what's happening here as well. So yeah, Henry's going to skip school. His mom is Sicilian. I think that's his in. If his mom wasn't from Sicily, I don't think they would have him. They wouldn't be so willing to take him on. And certainly his mom wouldn't be so suspicious. His dad is working class Irish, and I think that that's what drives the boy to be at this cab stand. He doesn't want to end up drunk with nothing to show for all of his hard work. It's a rejection of classic Americana. I mean, these scenes look like Leave It to Beaver, and every time Beaver is saying, nope, I want the dark side. I want the underneath. I want the celebrity of mafia.
Yeah, there's one scene where he's talking about how great it is. He's like smashing car windows, blowing up cars. He looks like a nice little paperboy. This young, I don't know how they got this kid that really looks a lot like Ray Liotta. I'm assuming that's what he looked like when he was 13 or whatever, but he looks like Ray Liotta. But yeah, he's doing horrific things.
And he gets busted for him, though. He was selling stolen cigarettes, and I like it when the people come up and are like, what are you doing? And he's so into the mafia mentality, he just stands there. He's not smart enough to even run from it. He's like, yeah, and so they get arrested. He never talks, he never squeals, and he gets congratulated by Pauly for it.
This is the single greatest advertisement for joining a gang ever. Is it not? Like the popping the cherry scene. Look, who wouldn't appreciate having this much fatherly approval come at them? You think, oh my God, I'm arrested. My life is over. Particularly at that age, you have all of these ideas about your entire life is doomed because one thing you did was wrong. To come out of that court and then to see all of these guys cheering you on, making jokes, it is like The Godfather. And I do start to even see those dynamics. They're not situated the same way, but Paul Sorvino looks and acts very much like Vito, Marlon Brando. And we do have a hothead with Tommy. We do have Jimmy, who's the eldest one that seems to be ready to run things on a day-to-day business. And you do have your main character, Liotta, is Michael Corleone, the innocent who we're going to watch get corrupted.
The difference between The Godfather and this, for me, again, The Godfather is like very regal, and it's almost like the mafia is these Shakespearean kings and their downfall and all that. This feels much more street level, maybe much more real in that way. We get a lot more understanding of how the mafia works in Goodfellas and Godfather. It's all about horse heads. Here, I love the line, we were the cops for people who couldn't go to the cops. We were police for wise guys. You get that sense. They're just stealing everything and selling it, and they're there just protecting people because they're criminals as well. Can't go to the police. I get more of a feel of what the mafia is doing in this film than Godfather, which is just much more about characters and their journey.
Organized crime isn't quite so organized here. It's more like a loose network of people who pay tribute. Versus in The Godfather, it feels like a well-run business. It feels like Wells Fargo or something, where Vito is the CEO and everybody's managing everybody and they're filing reports and things. Here, there's a lot of crime going on and Pauly knows about it. They pay Pauly, and in exchange, Pauly makes sure that things can keep going on. And if you don't pay Pauly, then he's going to take you down.
And of course, both worlds can be equally true. I mean, one view is from the top and one view is from the middle. We are having more of a grunt's eye view of how things are in Goodfellas and a more comedic one. I mean, Coppola was going for Shakespearean tragedy. This Scorsese can find humor in bloodletting. And early on, even these bloodletting scenes, they might be gross, but I don't think at any point we're repulsed from the family. I never feel like, wow, he should get out of this just because he sees some guy with a shot hand.
And then we jump to the modern day with Ray Liotta. After the kid gets his cherry popped, he's in this family. We get to see Joe Pesci with Ray Liotta at the club.
And as we go into the club, there is technical prowess behind. When we go into that bar the first time, we're introduced to every gangster, and I don't even know all their names. It doesn't matter. It's just one long shot going from table to table, winding around bars, and we're going to get this done even better later on in the film. But the technical aspects of this is just great as well.
This is why Martin Scorsese is so well celebrated. Michael Ballhaus is a terrific cinematographer, but you'll see this kind of work done in almost all of Scorsese's movies, even his earliest films. I can't ever remember a time when he wasn't concerned with using camera movement as part of the storytelling technique. You're always aware that you're watching visual storytelling, because there's never just static shots and television kind of editing going on. He wants you to be swept up. Another movie that did this, like Birdman. It's like the camera lifted me up at the beginning and it didn't set me down until the thing was finished. I am whisked briskly that I'm knee deep in bodies and blood before I even know it. That's the experience that Henry Hill had, is that before he could even realize the life that he was choosing, he was already in the midst of it. I mean, it was just cigarettes, right? It just looked like cigarettes and maybe some alcohol off the back of the truck, and now they're robbing airports. All of a sudden, in that 8 years, it's become a much bigger operation, and there's this guy Frenchie, who we know as the Heavy from Last Dragon, as well as Cat's Eye, who's got this in on how to steal some money from Air France.
Shonuff is in this movie?
No, the bodyguard that always watched the Sea Monster.
Oh, the gas man from Dumb and Dumber. Okay, I know who you're talking about now.
that's your go-to.
I don't even know what that is, but probably we're saying the same thing.
Yes, you are. I know what he's talking about.
We're seeing the crimes escalate, but again, no one gets hurt, right? When they ultimately do it, there's all of this concern, and you know, the camera pushes in as soon as Ray Liotta sees this guy walk in, and it pushes in on De Niro, and what's it going to be in all of this? But ultimately, they get slipped a key, they walk in a room, they come out with a suitcase. Easy money. Just say you want it in Vegas, no problem. It makes it look so easy and bloodless that what Henry had to do didn't involve anyone getting hurt at all. And they do skip over a little bit from Henry's life that's in the book. He did serve in the army. I think maybe they avoided that because, you know, that was Michael's rebellion and Godfather. It would seem like he's stepping away from the business. But there were other things that he did in those 8 years that did not involve mafia.
Well, you say bloodless. It doesn't take very long to realize that there is somebody very violent in their midst. Joe Pesci, who at this point in history would be best known as "They fuck you at the drive-thru! They fuck you at the drive-thru!" from Lethal Weapon 2. Here, taking his manic staccato speech and going a little bit psychotic with it. At the very first scene, is he going to shoot Ray Liotta? I thought he might.
I'll just start out with a negative, because everyone knows the positive. Joe Pesci is too old for this part. This guy is supposed to be the same age as Ray Liotta.
Well, Ray Liotta's supposed to be 21 at this point. They're all a little too old.
Okay, there's a little too old and there's really too old. And Joe Pesci almost didn't get this part for that reason. Scorsese's like, no, I want you to play the Pauly role. I just think that we need to have younger actors in this. This needed to be probably more like the character dynamics of Wolf of Wall Street, where we had those younger actors playing off each other. And Pesci just went to a makeup artist, got a wig, got the right clothes, and did some of the line readings. And they're like, you know what? You're just too damn good at this. We can't lose what you bring.
He's only 11 years older than Liotta. I mean, it's not like we're talking 20 years. And when you got De Niro walking around, he's the grandpa anyway. And they give him some Just for Men to hide the gray. But
but he is older.
I don't care, though, because Pesci is so good. Who else is going to do this? Do I amuse you? Am I a clown? Who else is going to do that?
Actually, this is all Pesci. We should give everything. It's not even the screenwriters.
Wow.
Pesci saw two wise guys do this one time, and during rehearsal, he sprang this on Liotta. Liotta did exactly what he did in this take as what he did in rehearsal, but it was more like, huh? What? What's going on? This was something that Joe Pesci wrote. It wouldn't be in this movie if someone else played it.
And Scorsese really fostered ad-libbing among the dialogue, and that's why this movie got the record number of fucks. Those number of fucks weren't in the screenplay, but when you ask these people to ad-lib, they're ad-libbing fuck all over the place.
Yeah, although I want to say he's big on that in rehearsal. When you come to set, he has meticulously calculated everything, and you are to hit your marks. He is not wanting people to come up with brand new ideas and change the structure and the layout of, like, no, this camera's going to go this way and you're not going to go any other direction but in the way we did in rehearsal. So I think Scorsese is the best of both worlds. He is encouraging of actors. He loves them. He wants them to inhabit these characters and show him things he doesn't know. But once that's all settled, that's locked. Now this vision must come to life, and it's all technical once he gets on set.
this is a great scene with Pesci. Am I a clown? Do I amuse you? But it shows us how dangerous he is. And then we see Henry go to Polly and say, hey, you got to do something about Tommy here. And you see Polly's hesitant to do something. It's just telling us how dangerous Tommy could actually be, that even the head of the mob in that area is kind of hesitant to really try to rein him in.
Yeah, we saw this nightclub owner, Sonny, just say, can you pay your tab and get a bottle in the head? So yeah, when he goes to Polly about it, Polly doesn't want to take ownership with Tommy. Tommy is a loose cannon. Everyone kind of understands that. He's very entertaining, which is why he lasts as long as he does. But everyone knows he probably is too hot to handle doing the core work, that he's probably just too dangerous. So yeah, it's just a great moment when Sonny's just like, maybe it's not a bad idea if you kill him. You can just feel that beat of like,
yeah.
Oh, maybe I said too much there. But one thing that's remarkable about the script, as free-flowing as it seems, where it's just a bunch of vignettes and stories, these characters ultimately always predict what's going to happen before it happens. Another case in point, Pesci during that scene says, hey, I think you'd fold under questioning to Leota. It's like he even knows the cliche is coming. It's like he knows this guy will eventually rat him out. Many times in this movie, you're going to see characters say things and it will be their fate. They know they're in cliches and it doesn't save them by knowing it.
And I think it's ego that prevents it. I mean, I think they joke they're in cliches, you know? They're, when he says you'll fold under questioning, it's the ha-ha, I'm joking, and yet it turns out to be really insightful. But I think they call themselves good fellas, but I feel like they think they're the untouchables.
Paulie later will say, he's talking about an old man that's 71 and dying in prison. He doesn't want to be that. Well, guess what? You are. And then this wife, we actually get a voiceover for her, a long-standing one. This was an interesting choice, but it's laid out in the book very much this way. There are segments where it stops being Henry's voice, and we just suddenly hear from Karen, and we learn about their very interesting combative love story.
That was whiplash-inducing, because the first half hour of this movie, you are in Leota's head, and he's in yours. He is the constant narrator for this, and he does go out on a date against his will with Karen, and it goes poorly. He actually likes her because she chases him down to confront him about how poorly the date went. They're going to end up getting married, and then she becomes a co-narrator. I did not expect that, and it is kind of fun, though, to have somebody give us an alternate strict third-person point of view so we can see Henry from the inside and the outside.
I mean, we brought up in Godfather, why didn't the women ever speak? Why don't we know their point of view? And so I like that here. You see her point of view, and is she complicit in everything that's going, or is she ignorant? That's always a mystery in those Godfather films. How much do the women know? But here, we're going to know. And again, it's just more engaging to me. Is that we're going to switch narrators and see it from someone else's point of view.
I couldn't help but judging Diane Keaton's K. Like, you just couldn't help thinking, you dummy. For years, you didn't see that. The doors were slamming in your face. And here, it's actually the opposite. She knows. It's what she's turned on by is the fact that he has a gun and he's so violent. She has this episode early on. She had a neighbor who hits on her when she's on a date with Henry and then later tries to pick her up, takes her in his car, and then sexually assault her. She barely got away. He left her on the side of the road. She calls Henry, and Henry not only comes to rescue her, but he marches right over there. I do think it's actually the most violent moment in the movie for me, because you expect there to be some tough guy talk at first, right? A stare down or, but the guy has no sooner said, hey, fuckwad, than he's on the ground just being brutally pummeled by Henry's gun.
Yeah, repeatedly with the butt of that gun. The gun looks almost broken when he hands it off to Karen, telling her to hide it.
I don't know if that's the most brutal scene, but it kind of puts me more on Henry's side again, because he's avenging violence against women. The police wouldn't do anything. He's going to go, and that guy's never going to improperly touch a woman again.
Well, we don't know that. He's never going to improperly go after Karen again, for sure. That has been laid down. And Karen knows. We know from her voiceover. My friends would probably get out of this situation. This is the moment when someone hands you a bloody gun that you go, you know what? I think we're done. I don't want this life. But instead, we see that wonderful match cut that says everything. She wraps the gun up and hides it in the milk box crate, and it instantly turns into a rap glass at their wedding, and they crush it. She even got him to convert, or at least say that he's half Jewish.
Her voiceover, the way she says it is, it's easy to forget he's doing illegal things. It's like he's just going to the office. She, Lorraine Bracco, was also a major player in The Sopranos. And one thing, when I watched The Sopranos, I always wondered, Carmilla Soprano often played dumb about her husband's activities, Tony Soprano, yet she knew, but yet she'd play like she didn't. I think rewatching this movie with that knowledge lets me see what they were portraying, which is the wife, who knows if deep down, but she's going to overlook things and just live in this fantasy land because they have the money, they have the house, they have this great life. And so she's going to forget exactly where these things come from.
Oh, no, she knows.
Well, I know she, that's what I'm saying, is, but she's choosing to ignore.
Well, I don't know how much she chooses to ignore, because later on, she's like, it's all seemed normal after a while, and the police just show up regularly with a search warrant. She sits there watching her sitcoms while they go through the house, and she talks about how those Italian women, they'll spit on their own floor. How disgusting. Why would you do that?
She wants something, and she wants something different than what she has. She has overprotective, controlling parents, and here's a guy that's going to take her away from all of that and let her have her own life, free of their control. I think there's a rescue element there, and I do believe it was maybe a little more clear in the book. For at least part of the courtship, she really believed when he said he was in construction, he was a bricklayer, that he was blue collar. That seemed like what he went and did during a day, was go to a construction site and make things. And metaphorically speaking, in mafia hierarchy terms, that is what he is. He's a bricklayer. He's not a mob boss. We see the wedding. We see her get all the hand out, so much cash that she's like worried it's going to get stolen. And he's like, no. No one would dare. You know, again, there's so many signs. She's choosing not to see them here, but it's telling there was no honeymoon, right? We instantly go from all of this money and this man that loves me to I'm staying up all night and my husband's not coming home and I have to go to these awful parties with pantsuits and double knits and women with bad skin.
She seems very okay with her husband. Her parents are mad at her and she's just defending him. That's just what guys do.
Even as a low-level mob guy, I found it a little bit odd that she'd marry him for money and power and they're living with her parents. That is not the idea of money and power I see.
It's more of a story of that time, though. I do remember, not my own parents, but at that time, until you could get established, that was more normal than I guess it is today, where you would be married and live apart until you could afford a house.
Yeah, other than Sally Struthers and Meathead, I don't know too many examples in my life.
Well, now you just stay at live at home until you can afford an apartment.
And eventually we work our way back to 1970 and that murder. It's happening so breezy, it takes me a beat to realize when I meet Billy Batts that he's the guy in the trunk. But shortly before Tommy arrives, I go, wait a minute, I know this one. And sure enough, this is going to be the death that changes everything. Billy Batts is 6 years out of jail, coming home. If Tommy was played by a younger actor, I think he would understand the offense of him confusing him for a shoeshine boy. Joe Pesci looks nothing like a shoeshine boy. If he ever was a shoeshine boy, it would have been 30 years ago. But if you had an actor in his 20s, you would understand that, hey, they got a lot to prove. They don't want to be reminded of when they were only a lowly gopher.
Yeah, I thought he was saying this guy was a shoeshine boy, not that he was confused with one. I did not recognize him as the guy from the trunk, though. And this is where we're getting introduced to the concept of the made man. And my memory was wrong. My memory of this movie was Joe Pesci was angling to be made at every turn, and he was constantly talking and pestering to be made. He wants it for sure, and it's going to become a big point, but he doesn't necessarily respect the rank of a made man. We're going to hear in the voiceover, made men are not killed unless you have meetings first and you have to talk with the mob leaders and agree to make reparations for killing a made man. And then, of course, we're going to see Tommy do it anyway.
I don't even know if it's about not respecting the concept of a made man. It's just that Tommy is such a hothead. We'll see what he does to a kid later named Spider. He just flies off the handle if you show him any disrespect.
And you know, Jimmy is always there to help. They are in cahoots. You might think that Robert De Niro might be the one to try and cool this guy off, but actually, he holds Billy Batts in his arms so that Pesci can shine his shoes. I mean, he helps put this man in the grave.
I think we see there that in this mob structure, we really do have this trio of guys who have each other's back. Jimmy, Henry, and Tommy, despite the fact that Tommy's a complete psychopath, you know, friends help you move, best friends help you move bodies, and these guys are best friends.
But it does seem like Henry, he's not okay with the killing. Like, that is where his look, you know, when this is going on, he's just watching and he's not helping like Jimmy is. We'll see, you know, we talked about how he's watching it at the beginning of the movie. I mean, they're going to go to Tommy's parents' house, played by Scorsese's mom, is Tommy's mom here. And I believe Scorsese's a funny guy because his mom, there's just something charming and funny about her role here and the way she acts, showing off these paintings and all that. But Henry always does feel like he's not at ease here.
Martin says, I put my mom into a situation because she's perfect for it, and I don't even direct her. Like, she didn't get a script or anything. They just sit these down. These are my friends, and she just played off the situation.
It feels like that. It feels like she's just friends with Pesci and De Niro and Leota. Her acting is so natural.
Yeah, exactly. She's willing to accept anything. Can I borrow this giant knife? We got to cut up a deer.
Stuck in the car.
I mean, anything. You know, there's banging literally coming from the Pontiac outside, and she's just wanting to nag him about when you're going to settle down and just being a regular old mother. I mean, again, she's so sweet, which is why it'll be so heartbreaking. I really worry more for her than for Tommy when the day for his being made comes.
Yeah, it is really funny when she's like, well, bring the knife back after you cut off the hoof. That knife is not going to be able to cut a dinner after cutting up through a bone.
And of course, because we saw the opening scene already, this is all foreshadowing. You know exactly how Pesci is going to use that knife because the guy is not dead in the trunk. And so we're back to where we began. And I do think everything is different now. This movie was a sugar rush where there was lots of blood, but none of it was on Leota. And after this point, I do feel like he gets dirtier and dirtier.
I really like the storytelling here in that there's this made man that they kill, and it seems to go away. It's almost metaphorical. They're going to build on that land. They have to go dig the body back up, and the stink is just so powerful. They have to move that body, and then you think it's all done with. And the fact that this is really going to be Tommy's final undoing, that this is a direct line to what's going to happen to Tommy at the end of the film, it's really good storytelling. When we review Serpico, I mentioned that I felt that was too loose storytelling and perhaps too documentary-like. This may be based on real events. All of this may be true, but the way it's told to us is so cinematic, it works really well.
It feels loose, but it's also tight. All these vignettes actually go together and tell a larger story. It's like a really good stand-up routine.
What I see is happening, more and more, Henry just gets compromised. The first thing he does wrong, he lies to Polly about it. He goes over to Polly's house, Polly, who's always good, always throwing parties, so kind to the wife and kids. He wants to know, they're busting his balls, what happened to this Gambino crime boss, a made man? And Henry's like, nope, don't know anything about it. And that, I think, is really the first sin that he really commits. I mean, yes, he commits crimes, but his first sin, the path of his downfall, is lying to Polly.
Or Polly's downfall. I mean, in the end, Henry's going to come out on top.
Yeah, we can argue that, but yes. And then, of course, he's not just lying to his boss, he's lying to his wife. He's got this mistress, Janice, and he's going to have more mistresses by the end of it. It becomes a very abusive cycle there at home. that Fridays are for the mistresses. It's actually just part of the family culture that, look, you take your girlfriend to the same club on Friday night, and Saturday you can bring your wives. There was even a story in the book where he was there on Saturday, saw his mistress, and almost went up and talked to her. Like, he forgot what day it was.
Because we were in Karen's head as well as in Henry's head, I didn't expect this. I kind of thought Henry was going to be loyal. I kind of thought those two would have each other's back, but it makes sense. I mean, this is the, at least the stereotype I've seen in media of mobsters, is they do have a series of women, or often it's just one. It's a mistress who is almost like a second wife. You don't go out and just cheat with everyone, but it was just this time a little bit like, oh, Henry's going there. Didn't expect that. That, to me, feels like his first real sin. Lying to Pauly, I was okay with, but now he's cheating on his wife. I thought those two were simpatico.
And Karen's getting a little mafia-minded as well. I mean, she gets crazy enough to pull out his gun. He wakes up, like, with it in his face. And again, Scorsese loves close-ups. He always has the best close-ups in his movies. They really signify, like, just sometimes things you don't even observe. But yeah, to wake up and have that barrel right in your face in that way, and having to talk her down from it, and then compromised again. You're right. He becomes the abusive husband. As soon as she lowers that gun, he slaps her, and then he's pointing that gun at her. These are two people that I believe really did love one another, but now that love is becoming self-destructive.
Yeah, even the scene before that is powerful, where Karen goes to confront the mistress and she's like banging on all the call boxes at the apartment complex. She's going to tell the supervisor, and you see the mistress, like, how freaked out she is. It starts going real dark once Billy Batts gets killed. This movie takes a very different turn. We're going to have Tommy taking out Spider for being too slow to bring him a drink.
Michael Imperioli. I was surprised how many actors I recognized here from The Sopranos.
You shouldn't be, because the creator of that show said Goodfellas is his favorite movie, and he specifically went out and found the actors in Goodfellas to bring into the show. He's not shy about admitting that he's referencing this film. I've actually never seen The Sopranos, maybe an episode here and there, but I don't know how well these characters here fit the characters that they play in that series. I know Lorraine Bracco plays a shrink, so she's playing someone very different, but also, I suppose, in a violent relationship with a mafioso. It's kind of like a marriage, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's a attraction there as well that she plays with. So The fact that she's in it, though, is what really struck me, even though she's not playing the wife.
But you're right. Henry's gone too far. Tommy had already been going too far. But at this point, it's not funny anymore. I mean, I think the line that gets crossed here, he can no longer read an audience. He doesn't know when to kill someone with a joke or kill them with a gun. And Spider did not deserve this. I mean, Spider is essentially Henry, right? He's the new Henry. He's the new gopher. We'd like this guy. We think he could be the next generation of Goodfellas. And instead, yeah, he's made to dance from bullets. And then ultimately, because he dares to speak back and stand up for himself, just gets mowed down by Tommy's gun.
The dancing from bullets I could see as a joke gone bad. You know, I, in my life, have known really stupid fucking people who would do that sort of thing. And they'd be like, oh, I shot your foot? Ooh, I never thought that could happen. But the shooting him in the chest for standing up for himself, I thought that might be an act that would garner respect, but not from Tommy.
He even says the line, is this a big deal? He's so deep in it at this point, he doesn't know what ethical behavior is.
Henry, the way Leota plays him, he's still our moral center, if you could have a moral center in this film, because we see Jimmer. We haven't talked a whole lot about De Niro, which is weird because he has the first billing in this, but he is kind of a background character, but he's really this amoral. He's goading Tommy and Spider. Tommy finally shoots him, and then Jimmy's like, I was just joking. Why you gotta be so serious? But he knows his place because he's Irish and he can't mess with a full Sicilian as well. But Jimmy has a different kind of danger feel to him. He's not the loose cannon like Tommy is, but he's willing to go along with whatever it feels like.
Yeah, you gotta watch for Jimmy. I mean, De Niro is a big star. It's the reason this movie got funded. This movie had no financing until Robert De Niro signed on, and then they had $25 million. So it's why it got made. But you're right. It seems like a smaller role for him. It's certainly not the show-off role he had in Scorsese's Raging Bull or Taxi Driver or even Mean Streets, which this is the closest to. But you got to watch him because ultimately, I think the more I've seen this film, the more I realize he knows he's stuck. He knows he can't advance through the ranks. So he does kind of pit people against one another, and he's there to swoop in and take their riches. He is, behind the scenes, quite conniving. He's called the gent because everyone thinks he's a gentleman, but really, he does some very ungentlemanly things while he's seemingly being nice to you. He's very two-faced and probably the most lethal of the three, even more so than Tommy, because at least Tommy, you know where you stand with him. With Jimmy, he comes at you smiling.
I don't know, with Tommy, where you stand with him can change on a dime. But Jimmy, I like that he's in the background here, because he's going to play a huge part in the climax. But having him there throughout, showing him as being friendly, showing him as helping to kill the made man and bury the body, it makes him feel like one of the brothers. I feel like these three are like brothers to each other, and sometimes your brother does something you don't necessarily agree with, like kill the bartender, but he's your brother and you're gonna stay by him. So that makes Jimmy's betrayal at the end all the more powerful that he's been there the entire time.
Yeah, and when it comes time to go to jail, Jimmy serves at a different prison. He was there at the same crime. They go down to Florida to shake some guy for money. They literally are going to feed him to the lions at the Tampa Zoo. And it just so happens that he's connected to a sister that works for the FBI. And they all get caught and sent up the river. Jimmy goes to a prison in Atlanta. Therefore, he doesn't get to have this Club Med version of prison that we see in this next section of the movie. That's just so much great fun.
And everyone got arrested, right? Paulie got arrested. That's why he's in there slicing the onions.
It said, it's all dialogue, but it's a different charge. He was in contempt of court for something else. You know, when you're a mobster, you got a court dates probably all the time. But he's serving a one-year sentence for something completely different.
And he's not slicing onions. He is slicing garlic paper thin. My wife's like, oh, I wish I could do that. She's mesmerized by how thin he could slice that garlic. And we see Scorsese's dad in this scene. He's the old guy there making the sauce with too many onions.
That's right, yeah. So Paulie had the garlic and the sauce had too many onions, but was still good.
Can you watch this movie without eating? I defy anyone. I couldn't. I wasn't even hungry when I sat down and watched this. And by this scene in the movie, I'm like, all right, what do we got in the kitchen? I got to eat.
I mean, they bring in the bread and the wine. Yeah, I'm getting hungry right now thinking about it.
Yeah, there is just something about the presentation of this. And again, the camaraderie as well, the warmth of all of this. This looks like fun. 10 years, you say? Okay, well, if it was 10 years of this, that wouldn't be so bad. But Paulie's only here for a year. And through some clever editing, he goes away pretty quick. And basically, Henry's there. We're going to find out when his wife comes to visit him without much means and resources. And she's not getting any cash or envelope showing up at the house either. They need to come up with a way of staying afloat during this decade of imprisonment. And that means drugs.
You know, we talk about Henry not telling Paulie about the death of Billy Batts. We see a betrayal here when he smuggles in the bread and the wine. He does have a bag of pills that he doesn't show Paulie. He hides that from everyone else.
Yeah, there's a scene where everybody's like playing cards, and it seems really conspicuous to me that Henry's pulling out this bag and shoving it in his shirt. I'm like, if I did that in a room full of people, someone would be like, what are you hiding under your shirt, Arnie? But he does that, and I don't get it. Between The Godfather and this movie, why are mobs so resistant to drugs? When Henry gets out, Paulie's like, I know you sold some drugs in there, but now you're out. Don't mess with the drugs. It's like, drugs are profit. Drugs are money. You are in the mafia.
Maybe they're too much trouble. I mean, when you're used to just robbing airports and semis, why get involved with drugs?
Obviously, gangsters get involved with drugs. Yes, it just so happens that the two most famous gangster movies have these ethical lines in the sand that don't exist. It just says a lot about Paulie that he's sticking with what he knows. I don't even think he has a moral problem with you taking drugs. It's that the way to stay out of prison is to do what we know, and these are the tricks of the trade. To avoid all of that, he doesn't want to see Ray Liotta's character go down the path of drugs because it might affect him. He might end up, well, exactly what happens. Again, I talk about characters that predict their own fates. I think he knows that he's weak here, that these men, if they were ever forced to talk about what they know, it would be the end of the whole thing. And so he only serves 4 years. Henry does get out relatively quickly, but he's hooked on drugs and he knows a guy in Pittsburgh and he's going to keep dealing those drugs so that he can still have those fabulous, tacky fabulous, I should say, houses.
This is quickly getting a little bit Scarface because we see Leota with just mounds of cocaine, snorting it, sharing it with his mistress.
New mistress.
Getting his babysitter involved.
Yeah, Debbie Mazar playing Sandy. I forgot she was in this film. As well as Martin Scorsese's real-life girlfriend, Ileana Douglas, is also here. I mean, everyone's somebody. It feels like a family production because Scorsese has worked with almost all these actors except for Leota before. And so I think we do get, as a climax, I mean, this is unusually structured. It's hard to talk about it in traditional form, but it is a traditional rise and fall. And I think as a climax, we get three big falls in a row. There is the Lufthansa heist that goes very bad. There is the making of Tommy. And then there's going to be Henry's flame out. They happen in quick succession and one being worse than the other. It seems like it should be this great thing that they pull off the biggest robbery of all time, $6 million off a Lufthansa flight. They should be proud of that, right? They just shouldn't go shopping.
Yeah, in this film, it's getting darker at this point, but it still has these moments that are funny. Like, they're having this Christmas party, and one guy, he walks in, they got a pink caddy. Another one, his wife's got this $20,000 fur coat. None of them cannot spend the money, and you see Jimmy getting quite upset.
What's weird to me about this ending is that these three things happen that aren't actually related to each other. It's synchronicity, maybe karma, but it's a little bit weird after all this time and after the $6 million heist, these anonymous people are going to come for revenge on Tommy for killing a made man while Jimmy is killing everyone. I kept getting confused and thinking Jimmy had Tommy killed because Jimmy was killing everybody involved in this, but Jimmy was actually the one most broken up because he was excited. Tommy was going to be a made man. Tommy was pure Italian, so he was the only one of the three of them who could. And because those three were so tight, Henry and Jimmy could act like made men. They'd be under Tommy's umbrella.
No, but this is what happened. Part of that confusion is what drove the plot. If you want to understand all of that, this is where the book will more clearly, step by step, walk you through what happened. But it was a big old tangled mess, and people didn't know if Tommy was whacked because of what he had done to the made man or because of his involvement with Lufthansa at first. It was a source of confusion. Here, Scorsese and Pileggi have actually neatened it up so that we get three separate things that feel like all part of the same downfall.
They all go together for me. You have Jimmy. He seems to be getting just more out there. Like, he's whacking Samuel L. Jackson and all these people because they're spending the money. Murray, the poor guy who gave him the tip about the flight, the wig salesman, he never gets his cut of the money and he's going to get whacked. I just feel like Jimmy, because he feels like Tommy's going to get that made man status, he could get more daring and more out there and start attacking people because he's going to be safe soon. And so the fact that Tommy gets whacked and now he doesn't have that protection from the mob, this is when De Niro really comes into the film, like that paranoia. He's going to even go after Karen at one point.
He does become the real villain by the end of it. Jimmy's the one I don't like. Despite all of this bad behavior, and you can make the argument that they're all equally bad, I suppose, but Jimmy is the threat to the characters I've decided I do like. And it is kind of heartbreaking to watch all of these guys. Yeah, maybe they shouldn't have spent the money. No, they definitely shouldn't have spent the money. And yet there was a double standard there. I mean, Henry was spending money. He didn't not blow it on his wife. And he did what they did. He didn't get punished for it. Again, it's more prophecy coming true. There was something that Henry said early on about the only people that get arrested are black guys that drive trucks and fall asleep. And that's exactly what happens to poor Sam Jackson. I feel bad for Sam. I had forgotten he was in this film, but nice cameo here. The one I love the most, for some reason, I don't know, is Carboni. I hate the fact he's been in there the whole time, and then for some reason, I think he's spared. We get this montage set to Layla, and then he's the last one. He's in that refrigerated truck, just dangling there on the hook. He takes 2 days to de-thaw. I was like, not Carboni, please.
And Stuart, you mentioned the music that it's all set to. This soundtrack, not even the score, just the soundtrack, the music that they use throughout this film, it's not music that I usually jam to. I don't like jam out to the Shangri-Las and all that, but I think the music is all perfect. The way you get a lot of like 50s and 60s like doo-wop and girl bands set to these horrible acts getting done. I just love the juxtaposition, but there's also like a love story. So great soundtrack. I would never like listen to this music on its own, but it works so well in this film.
Yeah, Layla was ruined for me when Eric Clapton cut that MTV Unplugged album. I'm like, this is terrible. But yeah, you forget there's that sentimental part of the Derek and the Dominoes one with a piano, and he just brings that piece in at the right moment. It's really actually one of my favorite montages maybe ever, of just cutting from the bodies and just, yeah, it's just suddenly heartbreaking. All of a sudden, I didn't realize it, but I care. I care about all of them. Even that stupid wig guy who was really annoying, always asking for his money. I don't think he deserved the ice pick in the back of the head.
Yeah, I barely recognized Layla. It took me a moment to like play the notes in my head a little further to realize what song that was. And I do groove to some of the music in this, you know, Cream and things like that. But yeah, a lot of it also is a little bit older. But I like that it was period proper. You know, they never use music you couldn't have heard in that scene.
Right. And this is Scorsese's bread and butter. I mean, he would have had a very successful career just making music videos if he wanted. He did do a few. Michael Jackson's Bad is probably the most famous. But he's always been at the forefront of combining rock and roll and imagery, you know, fast cutting, what's called MTV editing. He was one of the trailblazers on that. And particularly here with the Layla montage, we just see him working at peak form. Tommy getting whacked. Once you've seen the movie once, you always know it's coming. It haunts the entire film. Every time you're laughing at Tommy, in the back of your mind, you think, you're going to pay for that.
It's the only thing I really remembered coming back, watching this time, trying to remember what I got from it 20 years ago, was my father's reaction, because my father seemed really happy that this psychopath was getting made. And yet he also knew, he's like, they're going to kill him. They're going to kill him now. That was like my only memory from this whole thing, is Tommy was going to go get made and Tommy got killed.
I don't think I knew it was coming, but they start with him and his mother. He has a line. Don't paint any more of those religious pictures, please, Ma. And my brother has always thought that that was Scorsese taking a dig at Coppola. Like, you always put in this religious imagery, the baptism scene and all that. You don't need to do any of that. Just tell it like it is.
Well, little did they know The Godfather 3 coming out this year would be all about religion.
Oh, yeah, it's covered in those religious pictures.
Could be Scorsese just commenting on his own Last Temptation as well. Don't paint any more of those religious pictures.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but he did. I've seen Silence. He condoned.
True.
He wouldn't stop. But yes, perhaps take a break from them. But yeah, what a death scene. And there's nothing that Jimmy can do. This is where we get the very famous De Niro cry. I've known people that have turned the movie off because they literally can't stand to watch De Niro cry in the scene. It's a heartbreaker, I'll give you.
I don't know if I bought it or not. I mean, I don't know if I buy De Niro crying. He just seems stoic. He seems tough. He always plays that. When I see De Niro sad in films, it's a quiet sad. It's not a sobbing sad. So when I saw this, I'm like, is this really how De Niro would cry? Or is this bad performance? I can't decide.
Well, he is considered one of our macho actors. And again, he's usually going to extremes. We don't think of him being broken down by extremes. It's a rare moment that only his sappiest movies does he indulge in. But I just think it's painful. I do believe he loved Tommy. I do believe that that was the one guy he would have never whacked. That they were thick as thieves, excuse the expression. And there was just no way that he would have ever condoned what happened here, and nor did he expect it. You can tell from the look on his face, that transformation in the phone booth, that, yeah, he's just got to suck it up, and it's probably the most painful thing that's ever happened to him. But the final fall, the one that matters the most to us, our main character, is an extended comedic bit that feels like the last hour of Wolf of Wall Street. Let's watch Henry Hill freak out on drugs.
You talk about Scorsese doing music videos. This feels like a music video. I mean, we got that clock ticking, all these jumps. Leota just looking sweaty and clammy as he's looking at this helicopter following him all over the place.
The time signatures tell us this is coming to an end. We've seen other dates before, but the fact that we're now going hour by hour is like, okay, I wouldn't have known that necessarily. If I hadn't been watching the clock, I wouldn't know how far we were into the story or how far we were going to fall. But now everyone is told, as they're watching the clock tick, we're just hours away from this all completely unraveling and there being no other recourse for this character. Nowhere to run.
I mean, this is what happens when your babysitter forgets her lucky hat.
And is dealing your cocaine and getting on flights.
I wasn't sure if the lucky hat thing was that the babysitter had helped set him up, because that scene seemed so weird. Oh, I'm not going without my hat. I'm leaving. And then the cops came in. I didn't know if maybe she was a part of it, but my second favorite scene in this movie might be when they're negotiating with the witness protection program. Can I still see my parents? No, you can't see your parents. Well, what if she gets really sick? What if my mom gets sick? Well, maybe we could make a special exception. It's just, they don't understand the shit they're in. The other thing I don't know, because this is such a tight third-person narrative, everything we see is from their perspective. Would Jimmy have killed Henry? We're led to believe it. Henry believes it. But would Jimmy have killed Henry when Henry wasn't even involved in that $6 million heist?
I have to believe, yes. First of all, one, he wasn't in that heist because he was off doing something else illegal for Jimmy, and that's what Jimmy actually goes to jail for. So he is still a liability. He still knows things. He could still say things to the feds. And yeah, I also believe that he doesn't have the same compassion for Henry that he does for Tommy.
I mean, we're going to see Jimmy. He's going to go after Karen. He's asking her, what has Henry said? What he's been asked by the police? Jimmy whacked Maury, the wig salesman, because he just kept talking. Where's my money? Where's my money? And he got worried about him talking to the cops. That's what Jimmy is paranoid about.
And I like that scene with Karen where he's telling Karen to go down and go into this other building, and Karen looks in and gets this bad feeling and runs to her car. But we never know. We never see anyone chasing her. We're led to believe she would have been killed, but we never know.
I don't think it's that ambiguous. Yeah, it's not confirmed, but we know. We know very well that Jimmy is going to protect himself because that's what Jimmy does. If Jimmy would whack everyone else in Lufthansa because just maybe some authorities might get to them, he already knows the authorities have gotten to them. They are a burning liability. That the only reason he hasn't whacked them, it's pointed out, is because he doesn't want Pauly to know what he's done behind his back. And Pauly, Henry has to come to him too, and only gets $3,000 out of it. I mean, there is nowhere else for Henry to go.
And that is one of the most heartbreaking scenes for me. You talk about De Niro crying. For me is Pauly. He's like, here you go, $3,200. That's all he's worth to him now. He doesn't have a huge role like in this. Big guy, but not a huge role. Kind of just this silent guy that's always in the background. But he does feel like the father figure to Henry. And so that he writes him off and just gives him $3,000 after, you know, decades of work. That is a sad moment.
But I actually see Pauly's point of view. Pauly was burned. Pauly was cut out of the profits from the drug dealing. Now that you're at your lowest, you come to me for help. Here, you know, take the $340.
I don't think it was that he didn't get his cut. It's that he was lied to. He was disrespected. That always seems like the bigger sin with the mafia, is to disrespect the Don and lie to him than not just give them their cut.
And now he's given a toehold into the narcotics and the FBI. Now, suddenly, the whole family is going to be under much more scrutiny than it ever was before. Drugs are bad for that reason. Not because people get hurt. People always get hurt. That's the nature of things. But your drug habits and your drug dealing has made us all vulnerable. And that's more clear in the book. If that's an element that you wanted to know, the FBI, their voice, what they're doing. This movie makes it seem like they just came in right at the end, that they were part of the solution, but the FBI was really tracking them for many years. But they couldn't really get close until they had Henry. And Henry's ready. I get it. He hates being a rat. He was rewarded so much and adopted by all those father figures popping his cherry so long ago. And now he has to be everything he hates and take the stand against them.
And again, we get that style here that he breaks the fourth wall. And it's just so you know, we've heard his voice throughout the film, but now he's going to straight up address us in the courtroom.
Yeah, it makes it feel like it's an ending. In some weird way, it just him putting a bow in all of this. And we almost don't need to cut to where where he's going, we can imagine it's going to be, well, where we live, suburbia, right? That awful place where the rest of society is.
Yeah, where you're an average nobody.
As much as he might see this as a tragic downfall, that he gets to live probably better than I do, I don't feel that bad for him. I really don't think that he is suffering enough.
I found that to be a wonderful twist, is that now that it's all said and done, he's like, what am I now? The life is boring. It really ties back to, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And now he had to give that up. Giving up Polly, giving up Jimmy, that was preservation. But now he has to live with the consequences of that and try to live a straight life. The thing he always wanted, he had to give up. It's a very Faustian deal here.
And yet we would find out from the inner title that just a few years after selling the life rights to a book, he would then be dealing drugs and get caught again. And Who knows what else he's been doing since. He's remained clean. He hasn't gone to jail again, but maybe he didn't go the straight and narrow life that he would have us believe here at the end. But it is a nice place to leave it. And certainly closing out with Sid Vicious's My Way feels
so good.
Like the right note to end on.
And we get a cut to what? Tommy? Thinking of Tommy shooting him?
Well, there's only one way out for gangsters, right? Tommy's way was the way you're supposed to go. Hail of bullets. Would he have been happier going out earlier in the prime of his life, getting a bullet and not expecting it? Well, it certainly would have maybe fulfilled his fantasy more, but I don't know. How much has he made off Goodfellas? Probably quite a lot. How much did he make off My Blue Heaven? I mean, the guy's rich. I can't feel that bad for him. And I also just want to point out, we know that Polly ended up dying in jail. It's mentioned that Jimmy Conway could get out in 2004. Nope.
Did he? I didn't look that up.
Nope. Died of cancer in 1996.
Oh, okay.
So he never saw the light of day, which may be why Henry Hill has appeared more often in public.
Yeah, started calling it Howard Stern all the time once they were dead.
Yeah, he's actually appeared at film screenings for this movie and done a little bit of promotion and puts himself out there from time and time again.
So, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Goodfellas? Jacob?
I think I tipped my hand very early as we started talking about this. Yeah, I love this movie. Again, Ray Liotta, like out of nowhere, don't know who this guy is, doesn't ever need to do anything again. He's got Goodfellas. He's good in my book. He is such a strength and a shocking coming from a virtual, like, nobody almost. His sense of style, then you got De Niro, you got Pesci, like, everything comes together in this film. It feels like just a kind of a freeform jazz, crazy drum solo. Hold on to the edge of your seat, we're just gonna go through this crazy crime story. But it all works. It doesn't ever let up. When I watch this on TV, like I said, it's like 3.5 hours because of commercials. I could not turn it off. I needed to see what came next after that Coca-Cola commercial I was watching. I needed to know what the next scene was. Like, yeah, it's a gripping story. The style it's told in, the cinematography. Again, there's a couple shots with just these huge long takes that wind all through restaurants and the kitchens and everything. Just amazing. Yeah, strong recommend. Strongest recommend possible for Goodfellas.
Stuart.
Yeah, I think we need to consider best mob movies ever. You know, this is going to be in that mix, you know, and I think it's going to come out on top. Godfather 1 sacrificed the morality for the entertainment value. It was a lot of fun to watch, but I ended up feeling like it told a bullshit story on some level. And Godfather 2 tried to change that. It reemphasized that Goodfellas aren't so good after all, but neither was the story. It was more sloggy and just less entertaining to watch. This movie gets the best of both worlds. It really sells the highs and lows of daily life of mobsters, but the energy never flags. You never feel let down by this film. It lifted me up and carried me the entire way and set me down breathless. Scorsese has tried to do this many times in his career. He has all kinds of love for cinema trickery and using the camera to tell stories in a visual way, but he's never been this successful before or since. Part of that is this voiceover. Yeah, might be a killer in some movies, but you got to look at this voice. It's authentic. Henry Hill is the real guy that lived this, and it comes through. I mean, if this were Mario Puzo or some writer imagining what a gangster would be like, this movie would be Casino, which is all of these very talented people coming back and trying to do it again and not nearly getting the mileage out of it the second time around. The authenticity of this voice is a big part of why this movie is always going to grab you. But yeah, I also am going to argue Goodfellas the movie is better than Wise Guy the book, because Scorsese and everyone in cast and crew is working in peak form. They are all just giving you camaraderie, backbiting drama. There's so much to feel here that you're never going to get off the page. The story comes alive through all of their choices, and it's just about the best thing that anybody in this film has ever done. So, yeah, highest of recommends, my favorite mob movie, and maybe the greatest film Now Playing has ever covered. It's a once-in-a-life miracle.
Well, I love this movie. It sucks coming after such effusive praise, because I don't know that I'll say best movie Now Playing's ever covered. So I won't go quite that far. I really like it. I'll probably agree with best mob movie. I haven't seen every mob movie out there. Best mob movie I've ever seen, though. I'll put it that way. I can't even say necessarily it's my favorite Scorsese film, though. I think I like Wolf of Wall Street even more. But I do love this film. I mean, I'm splitting hairs as thin as Paulie slices garlic when I say I like Wolf of Wall Street more than this film, because I really love both of the films. And I think they're my favorite Scorsese films right there, one and two, because they are more comedic. They're fun, and yet they're deplorable stories of horrible people doing terrible things, which makes that a little bit more fun. I agree. I think this glamorizes mafia life a little bit more than The Godfather does, in that it looks like a fun ride, even though, yes, it also shows the consequences, whereas in The Godfather, the consequences always are a bullet. Here, the police are actually effective and can bring some pressure to bear. But the filming style, as you mentioned, the editing, the various montages. I love the montages of finding all the bodies at the end, where Jimmy's just killed people and people are falling out of garbage trucks and things like that. No, and Joe Pesci, he's an actor that can really get on my nerves. In the wrong vehicle, Joe Pesci.
Someday we'll do Lethal Weapon. We could talk about that.
Lethal Weapon 2 is one of the better ones. Lethal Weapon 4 is one of the more lethal ones.
Yes.
Where he's like the real estate agent. He is like garlic. Used correctly, he enhances the flavor. Used incorrectly, it becomes inedible.
Too many onions sometimes.
Yeah, here he's never been better. It's a good movie of Goodfellas. Strong recommend.
Yeah, I agree with you. Wolf of Wall Street, when thinking about the DiCaprio series and why none of those come close to this, I think Wolf of Wall Street is the one that comes close to the spirit of Goodfellas. They were really trying to go for that feel. I think it overstayed its welcome. It's hard to make a comedy at 3 hours. There was like a half hour too much in that film. And I also would just say, while that voice may be authentic Wall Street broker, it was also just less interesting. I wanted to find out about the mob. What Jordan Belcher wanted to tell me, I think I already assumed.
I've always found a fascination with Wall Street, so.
Well, you were going to be a broker in your early youth.
So yes, I think that may have just interested me more. I was also going to be a mobster, Jacob, for at least a week.
True.
Yeah, I think we're all glad you didn't make that choice. But speaking of choices, what are we doing next for the patron?
We don't know. We really don't know. Choices yet to be made. It is a TBD, but you can influence it. I mean,
you can let us know some things you'd like us to cover. You can donate to a certain amount and make us cover, or we'll just surprise you. But we greatly appreciate the continued support of showing up and being a patron and letting us do one-offs that are not sequels and parts of series that we would have to cover anyway.
Absolutely. Hear, hear. So thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. Now Playing. This podcast is better than sex, baby.
I disagree.
Depends, right?
The hardest thing for me was leaving the life. I still love the life. And we were treated like movie stars with muscle. We had it all just for the asking. Our wives, mothers, kids, everybody rode along. I had paper bags filled with jewelry stashed in the kitchen. I had a sugar bowl full of coke next to the bed. Anything I wanted was a phone call away.
Everybody had their hands out. Everything was for the taking.
And now it's all over.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. And we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Better than sex, babe.
Now playing relies on support from listeners like you to keep going. So thanks to you all.
Don't forget about money. You can afford a Maury wig, price to fit every budget. So call me now.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
What's right is right. You understand what I'm talking about?
No, I mean, the kids over here, we're hugging and kissing over here, and 2 minutes later, he's acting like a fucking jerk.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended. Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the express written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Nobody goes to jail unless they want to, unless they make themselves get caught. They don't have things organized.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I fucking believe that. In this day and age, what the fuck is this world coming to?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2018, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
What the fuck is it with you? I thought I was getting pinched over here. He's hanging on my fucking neck like a vulture, like a pending day. What do you want?
Now take me to jail.